The economy is rebounding after all the pandemic shutdowns. Businesses are reopening and customers are pouring into shops, restaurants, and entertainment venues looking to spend money. One small problem, finding employees to staff those businesses.
It's been very thin, very, very few applicants.
So where are all the applicants? And what are businesses to do? We look at what the research says, and for people who are struggling to get by, whether because of the pandemic or other factors, something called guaranteed minimum income could help. You'll be seeing it offered in a number of different places. We look at what that's all about.
Well, shake it up, baby. Shake it up, baby.
And the Beatles. Their music has been shaking things up for more than 60 years, and radio host Chris Carter has been bringing their music to a passionate audience for 20 years now. We talked to him about his radio show and the enduring appeal of the Fab Four that you've been listening to
all your life.
Fox 11 News In Depth starts right now. Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner. At this moment, a year and a half into the COVID-19 crisis, it's hard to believe, but the U.S. economy is actually booming. The economy is actually growing at the fastest pace in a quarter century, though the emergence of the Delta variant has slowed things down a bit. But while some sectors thrive, others seem stalled or actually heading south. One of the biggest obstacles to the thriving economy seems to be actually finding and hiring employees. Here to talk with me about all of this from the University of Pennsylvania is Ioana Marinescu. Did I say that right?
Marinescu.
Okay, Marinescu. I apologize for that. And she's an associate professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania. And why does it seem so hard for these businesses to get people? Why aren't people getting out in groves and trying to snap up these jobs?
People are getting out and trying to snap jobs, but you have to realize that the economy, as you said, has rebounded. We're at 5.4% unemployment rate, which is similar to what we had in 2015. As a result, there's a lot of businesses trying to hire at the same time, and there's only a limited pool of applicants. And as more and more businesses are trying to hire, it's harder and harder. They're competing with each other and are finding hard to fill their vacancies, especially if those vacancies are low wages and therefore not particularly attractive, at least to some of the candidates.
So if the economy is booming and hiring is dipping, the unemployment rate, is that an illusion?
So, you know, hiring is actually reducing the unemployment rate. And restaurants, for example, have been one of the sectors that have grown the most over the past 4 or 5 months. They have trouble hiring, but they're still growing. It's just that they want to grow even faster. And that's just not been possible because, again, everybody trying to hire at the same time, they're kind of, you know, dipping into each other's sauce and trying to compete with each other for applicants.
We've heard one reason why people may not be going after these jobs is because they're getting money from unemployment. So what do you say to people who may be doing that or that idea that that's what's going on? Is it?
Right. So, you know, the unemployment benefits are probably playing a small role in this. My research shows that more generous unemployment benefits tend to reduce the number of applications. However, the effect in the end really depends on the number of applicants that are going to businesses relative to the total number of jobs that are out there. And people who have looked recently at the expiration of those benefits, as you might know, some states have stopped the benefits early. They looked into whether that really increased employment and they found very, very small effects. So it's probably playing a role, but it's a very small role. And the biggest role is really the growth itself. That means that businesses are trying to grow faster than they can given the limited pool of applicants.
All right, so Dr. Marinescu, in your research, are you finding that some of these jobs that are out there for people are just so low paying that they're waiting for a better job to come along?
That's exactly right. So, in fact, you know, we know that people are targeting a certain wage that tends to depend on whatever their prior wage was. So if somebody, you know, before the pandemic was an executive assistant, then may not want to be a waiter now and making minimum wages. And so, you know, again, people try to look for jobs that are similar to what they had before. And as a result, some of the lower wage jobs may not be very desirable. And to the extent that the economy is booming, job seekers rationally expect to be able to find other better jobs and are just waiting around.
So, you know, it's interesting because we've talked on this program over the last year and a half about fear. and the impact that fear has in our thinking. And so does fear play a role in this? Either businesses are concerned about what their future is, or potential employees are concerned about what their future may be, because with the Delta variant, we can see that things can just sort of change overnight.
Right. So, you know, that's definitely could be a concern on the employee side, so that they don't want to go into a job that has high customer contact, such as restaurants and retail. So that could play a role. And, you know, from the point of view of the employees, it also might mean that, you know, if they can afford to wait a little bit, they'd rather take a job that is going to be more COVID-proof. Because suppose that the thing goes south again, you know, if they're able to work in a job that it's possible to do from home, they will be protected from potentially another job loss in the near future.
Yeah, so did you find in your research that people are just worn out?
So, you know, we've seen during the collectively, we economists look at the pattern of applications during, you know, the COVID crisis, and we have seen a certain, you know, flow of people away from customer contact jobs and towards jobs that have less customer contact and that can be done online or, you know, remotely. So we've definitely been seeing that.
So what could you tell employers out there that might be watching, things that they could do in order to be, you know, attracting more people into the business?
Absolutely. So one thing we know is that increases wages is something that does work. And, you know, you can expect that if you increase your wages by about 10%, you might be able to attract 1% or to 2 or 3% more people. So that's definitely something that can work. And, you know, when you think about it, it is costly. But on the other hand, having unfilled jobs is also costly. So that's one way to go. Another way to go is to make the job better for people in other dimensions, for example, by allowing them to have more schedule flexibility, or at least give them longer notice before shifts, which can be important for a lot of people who have family responsibilities. And third, you should consider, you know, hiring in pools that maybe you weren't looking at before and providing people with mentorship or training on the job so that they're able to do the job, even though perhaps on paper it doesn't look like they are the best qualified.
All right, Dr. Ioana Marinescu, hang on for just a second. She's going to be joining us for another segment. Coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth, what if everyone was provided a minimum amount of money to live on what they call a guaranteed minimum income? Would that be a lifeline for the poorest and the most desperate among us, or just an excuse for people to be lazy? We'll take a look at that on the other side of the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Fox 11 News In Depth. I'm Hal Eisner. About a month ago, California lawmakers approved the first state-funded income plan in the United States. After the governor signs it, it would basically approve monthly cash payments to qualifying pregnant women and young adults leaving foster care. It's an idea that has been gaining support in local jurisdictions, including here in Los Angeles County, where a guaranteed income program was just approved. A similar local program is called the Compton Pledge. And joining us right now here on Fox 11 News In Depth is Nika Soon-Shiong. She's the executive director of the Fund for Guaranteed Income and backers of the Compton Pledge. And reporting to discuss is social policy professor Dr. Ioana Marinescu, who we had in the last segment. Let's start with Nika, and tell us exactly what it is we're talking about here with regard to a guaranteed income.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. So a guaranteed income is a policy of direct recurring cash that is not conditional, doesn't place work requirements on recipients. And we've been implementing this through the Fund for Guaranteed Income, particularly through our first initiative, which is the Compton Pledge. It's a two-year guaranteed income program that to 1,770 beneficiaries in Compton is delivering between $300 and $600 monthly over the course of 2 years.
And Ioana, why don't you pick up on that? Because to you, what does it mean to have such a program in local jurisdictions?
So, you know, this is the kind of program that research has shown is going to have a positive effect on the health and education of people, especially the most disadvantaged children and youth. So, you know, we talked about pregnant women right there. So I think the program has a lot of promise.
You know, you talk about a minimum guaranteed income, Nika, and sometimes that becomes a big controversial sort of debate. What are these two sides and why is this such a hot button issue for some people?
Sure. I think, you know, the debate often comes down to, well, how are we going to pay for it? You know, do these people deserve to really to live? And our perspective is that it isn't a debate. We are in an economic crisis. We are in one of the largest recessions since the Great Depression. And the question of, well, is it costly to pay for guaranteed income? We can look at the child tax credit expansion, for example. And child poverty costs the US between $800 billion to $1.1 trillion every year. So the expansion of the child tax credit will generate anywhere between $260 and $367 billion of benefit to society. So yes, it is costly to pay for a guaranteed income, but it's even more costly in terms of the cost to our economy and the human costs not to do so. We are facing an eviction crisis, a crisis of structural inequality and poverty that's unsustainable. And so the time has come to really look into not only is it right to implement this policy, but how do we do so? So at the Fund for Guaranteed Income, we've done a number of things to address these questions. In particular, we've built a payments platform that enables unbanked, underbanked, undocumented residents to deliver and to receive these resources, in addition to a robust customer service function and also also other resources in the community.
Talk for a second, though, about the Compton Pledge, because I just want to hear a little more about what that is. And, you know, there are two words, Compton Pledge. What does it mean?
Sure. So our Compton Pledge is a pledge to people's power. It's a community's vision for freedom. The Compton Pledge is a two-year guaranteed income program that for 800 households is delivering between $300 and $600 monthly for that for 800 households is delivering between $300 and $600 over the course of 2 years. And for these participants, we are offering access to a number of resources in the community, a tailored set of resources that we've made partnerships with. It's led by a 20-person community advisory council. That's pastors, residents, heads of local nonprofits, and other residents in the community.
And how are people selected for this?
Sure. So there was a random selection process, and we made sure to represent the community in general in terms of demographics, in terms of race, percentage of undocumented, percentage of formerly incarcerated, and gender.
Iana, are we looking at the future here? Is this something that you think really has legs?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the pandemic has proven that society is ready to implement some of these policies, especially when it comes to children who, you know, in the United States are disproportionately victims of poverty. And, you know, with potentially dangers of job loss ahead coming from automation, you know, which might not happen immediately, but it's something that we want to be ready for. This is a way to insure ourselves against such issues in the future.
And Iana, let me just ask you, there are other countries that do this, right?
Well, you know, absolutely. In terms of the child allowance in particular, the U.S. is one of the few rich countries that doesn't have one. And especially we do have a child tax credit, but this wasn't going to the lowest income households who needed the most. Whereas in most other countries, you know, it's unconditional. You know, you just get it straight up as cash for your children. And so this is nearly aligning the U.S. with policy in many other countries, including in particular Canada, where the policy has been shown to both reduce child poverty and, you know, help poor families more generally.
And Nika, you've been nodding your head for every word that she said there. So you must have some follow-up thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, we can look at the history of the growth of unconditional cash transfers internationally since the 1990s. You look at both Familia in Brazil, Oportunidades in Mexico, the social grants in South Africa. This is not a new idea, the idea of universal and unconditional cash, but it's new to the United States, where we really have seen, thanks to an organization called Mayors for Guaranteed Income, at the municipal level, a strong commitment to guaranteed income policies and programs. But I think we should learn from the international experience that we do know how to deliver cash transfers. And we should apply that to the context of the US, particularly given the fact that there have been movements such as One Fair Wage, National Domestic Workers Alliance, who have been able to deliver emergency cash relief to their members, many of whom are excluded from welfare programs.
All right, Nika Soon-Shiong, thank you very much for joining us. And Iana Marinescu, See, I didn't get it right at the beginning of the show, but I got it right at the end of your segment, right? Thank you both for joining us. I really appreciate it. Good information, and we'll check back with you again coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth. The KLOS radio program Breakfast with the Beatles has been around for more than 30 years. And for the past 20 years, it's been hosted by a man who's passionate about the music and the Fab Four. And we'll meet him on the other side of the break. Don't go away. Welcome back. If you missed the beginning of Beatlemania back in the 60s, and I can tell you from having been there myself, it was an almost unimaginable hysteria over four guys from Great Britain. Girls screamed and swooned and passed out whenever John, Paul, George, and Ringo appeared. And whoever thought that the passion for the Beatles would last this long, who would have possibly thought? Well, maybe our next guest would have thought, Chris Carter. Chris Carter, good to see you, Chris. Chris is the host
of
the radio.
How are you?
I'm well. Beatle Howe, thank you for that, Beatle Chris. He's the host of the radio program that focuses on the Beatles, which has been on for decades now. It's the 20th year of what we call this, Breakfast with the Beatles. And so why don't we talk a little bit about what this 20th year means to you and how do we keep the Beatles alive all these years?
You know, the Beatles do it themselves, Hal. We don't even have to help. It's an amazing thing. No matter what year it is, you know, after a while you think, you know, this is going to wear off after a while. But here we are in 2021, and the Beatles are probably, you know, at their peak, if you can believe that. It's incredible. Their albums still sell. Young people, Hal, still love the Beatles. Half of the requests, more than half, right, Louise?
More than half.
More than half of the requests we get are from, you know, kids under 10 years old. And that says something.
It says a lot. You know, you took over the show from Deirdre O'Donoghue. That was back, what, in 2001? How did that happen? Give us a little history lesson.
Well, like everyone else in Southern California, I listened to Breakfast with the Beatles religiously every Sunday morning. And I actually remember the Sunday morning where we just kept hearing Beatles songs and there was no Deirdre. And she sadly passed away. And, you know, your first thought, obviously, is, oh, my God, what happened to Deirdre? And then your initial, you know, your second thought is what's going to happen to Breakfast with the Beatles? You know, you don't want to keep that carrying on. And I guess I wasn't alone in that. And to make a long story short, they had a contest over at KLSX at the time. Where they had five different DJs all hosting Breakfast with the Beatles over the summer. And at the end of the summer, they had a vote. And whoever, you know, won the vote got the gig. And I won the vote and I got the gig. So I've been there ever since. And then they started a Beatles channel on Sirius XM radio. And I got that gig to do the morning show Monday through Friday morning. So with my British Invasion show on the weekends, I actually do 8 shows a week, Hal. Just like the song.
So yeah. Were you always a huge Beatles fan? I know for people who can't see behind you, he's in kind of what I would call a Beatle cave. And this place is full of memorabilia. This is at his home. But tell us a little bit about if you were always a Beatles fan from the very beginning.
From the very beginning, my first album I ever got was Rubber Soul. And it's still my favorite Beatle album. But the Capitol Records version, you know, because there's two, the Beatles put records out in England with different songs on the same album. But the Capitol version of Rubber Soul has been my favorite since I got it. And it was a love affair that just never stopped, you know. And I love the solo Beatles as well. You know, I'm a big fan of Wings and the Plastic Ono Band and George's All Things Must Pass, and love the solo stuff almost as much as the Beatles stuff.
Yeah, I think my first record was I Want to Hold Your Hand, and my second was She Loves You. And what I want to tell you is that, you know, it is remarkable as a child back in those days to have this influx of music, this influx of stuff coming over from Great Britain and sort of enjoying it and absorbing it all. How do you, though, now, all these years later, keep fresh content out there?
Well, you know, because we're on every day, we are always, you know, cognizant of the day of the week. You know, it might be the anniversary of Revolver. It might be the day, you know, John Lennon got married to Cynthia. Whatever happened on that day, we usually highlight it and then, you know, put songs around it. And it just keeps it fresh that way. And you know how, you got to love the Beatles because they keep putting out new material, even though it's 50 years old, 60 years old. For example, the new All Things Must Pass 50th anniversary deluxe set that they put out, which is the whole All Things Must Pass album all remixed. And then you had the John Lennon Plastic Ono Band remixes and all the McCartneys. So that's keeping it fresh. And you get this new Beatles stuff, like we have a brand new version of Let It Be, which is now going to be called Get Back, directed by Peter Jackson. That's going to be airing on Thanksgiving weekend on Disney Plus. So all new stuff from the Beatles in 2020.
And it's also exciting, too. As somebody who grew up with the Beatles, I just really have always enjoyed their music. What was the most memorable moment for you in these past 20 years?
Oh, my God, I've had so many. You know, we've had the opportunity to have both Paul and Ringo on the show a bunch of times over the years. I was just telling a story on the radio. It actually has to do with a Beatle wife more than a Beatle, but George Harrison's wife, Olivia, listens to the show. And so does her mother, apparently, who's in her 90s, and she still lives in Southern California. And one day, after I had done a George Harrison birthday show on a Sunday morning, on the next day, on Monday, I got a call, and it was Olivia Harrison, George's wife. And she called me to tell me that her mom called her to say that nice boy was playing 3 hours of George music on his birthday. So Olivia called to thank me. She said, my mom just called me and told me you did that for George, and we want to thank you for that. And then she went on to tell me that she was in the kitchen looking out the back window, and it was raining. And she said, you know, George used to love to go out and do his gardening when it was raining. And then it dawned on me, she's calling me from Friar Park in England, in that big castle. And here I am in Sherman Oaks, California. And at that moment, I realized what a great job I had hosting breakfast.
It's quite a story, and you've got many of them. And thank you so much, Chris. We've got to wrap it up. But congratulations on the anniversary. Celebrate well. Thank you, my friend. Good to see you again. And we'll be back.
Thank you, Beatle Howl.
Fox 11 News In Depth coming up right after this. And finally, if you haven't already, please check out my podcast, What the Hal. It's available wherever you subscribe to podcasts, or just go to whatthehalpodcast.com. That's it for this week's Fox 11 News In Depth. Have a great week, and thanks for being together with us.